History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions and then invest a little time to listen as memories from long, long ago start to come to life again. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired when our veterans let us into the experiences they've been carrying with them for all these years. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you know we've focused almost exclusively on World War II veterans over the years. But in the future, I'm sure we're going to be hearing more and more from veterans who served in later conflicts. They're not getting any younger either. And when it comes to the Vietnam generation, many of those who served are dealing with the long-term effects of exposure to Agent Orange. Decorated helicopter pilot Harry Zinser of Hanford, California is one of them. A 26-year veteran of the Navy who later launched the junior ROTC program at Lemoore High School, where he spoke as strongly and clearly as could be as a history teacher, Harry now battles Parkinson's disease because of exposure to Agent Orange. That has affected his speech, but it has not stolen his memories, which are pretty intense and colorful. And this month, he marked the 50th anniversary of a daring rescue mission in Vietnam that earned him the Navy Cross. We're going to hear all about that, but as we always do, let's start with the early years. Tell us where you grew up, Harry.
I grew up in Flint, Michigan. My parents were both immigrants from Germany. Dad came over in 1923. He said he came through Ellis Island, of course. He said he didn't have 10 cents to buy a cup of coffee, but he had a promise of a job in New York. So that's where he settled in New York, Brooklyn, New York, as a butcher. I was born in New York. I was 1 year old, we moved to Detroit. Then when I was started school, I was in Flint, Michigan. I was there through high school. And I had an older brother who lived in the house with me. His name was Herb. We were both named after presidents. So our parents wanted us to have American names. My brother was born, Herbert Hoover was president. I was born, Harry Truman was president.
So growing up there in Flint, do you remember as a child having some thoughts of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do? Did you ever think at that young of an age that you might be a pilot someday?
No, never thought I was going to be a pilot. I always planned on being a coach. I played football in high school, played football in college, so I was going to be a coach. Mm. And my goal was to be a Big Ten coach. That was my goal.
What position did you play?
Well, in high school, I was a quarterback, and then I was transferred to a halfback in college. I enjoyed playing halfback very much for Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois.
Any fun memories from your college football days that stand out?
Oh, yeah, I have lots of memories. Like, I remember... When I was a freshman, I was dressed for varsity. I was one of two freshmen dressed for varsity games. I played left half behind an all-state halfback. He was a very good player. It was Dean Troyer, and he got injured. And I thought I was a third back. So all of a sudden, Coach Zinser, get in. Man alive, I got in there, and it was the first game of the year. It was a night game, and it was raining. We'd been from Michigan. It was just my climate, you know. So I plowed straight ahead. I was nicknamed Harry the Horse after that game. I dragged a few people across the goal line once or twice. Like, I had a great game. That was my first game.
So your very first game in college is one of only two freshmen that's actually dressed. Your number gets called, and you're dragging people across the goal line and getting your own nickname. That's a pretty good debut.
I'd say it was pretty good, yes.
How long did they call you Harry the Horse?
Well, for the 4 years that I was there.
I'm sure you had some other good games or some other big memories.
Well, I remember one game we played North Central College, which is a powerhouse football in our league. My brother, he came from Michigan, and he drove up there because he wanted to watch me play that game. He got there about 2 minutes after the game started, and we were ahead 7-0 already. He asked somebody to say next to me, he said, where did you get 7 points from? They said, first play of the game, the halfback ran for a touchdown. So the first play of the game, I got a 65-yard TD run. That was my senior year.
But your brother missed it.
And my brother missed it, yes.
Well, I know you've lived a lot of life since then, but it's the start of college football season right now, and there's a lot of young men who are dreaming about, you know, them being Harry the Horse and dragging guys across the goal line or running 65 yards. Is there something you look back on and see that 4 years of college football did for you, an impact that playing college football had on you?
Well, I think so. I think it teaches you a lot. It teaches you how to It's How to Live, I think. Good Principles.
Is there a coach that had a specific influence on you?
Yes, both my head coach and our backfield coach at Wheaton College. Head coach was Jack Schwartz. He's a great guy, and then our backfield coach is Bubba. We call him Bubba. Yeah, he's a cool guy.
And this was an interesting time to be a college football player or a college student in general because the Vietnam War is going on. How did you feel about the prospect of ending up in the service? Were you concerned about being drafted? Did you have other plans?
Yes, I had other plans. Like I said, I plan on being a coach. And then suddenly my senior year comes, and we're sitting around our dining hall, and we all open our mail there, and I had a draft notice. Oh, wow, what do I do now? Said, you have until such and such a date to find a service of your choice. If you're not enrolled in a service of your choice by such and such a date, you'll be drafted into the Army. So I said, man, the Army, the life expectancy of an infantry officer was 2.5 months. And well, man, did I go to college for 2.5 months? No, so what else do I do? One guy said, hey, come down, take a test with me. I said, I'm going to be a Navy pilot. I remember saying to him, you mean an Air Force pilot? He said, no, Navy pilot. I said, Navy pilot? Says, Navy has pilots? Well, I thought they just had ships. Did you ever hear of aircraft carriers, Harry? Sure, I've heard of aircraft carriers. Who do you think flies off of them? The Navy, huh? So then I took the test, and I passed the test.
Did you have an idea of what kind of pilot you wanted to be, what you wanted to fly?
I wanted to fly the big Super Connies. Before I went to flight training, I had a... 1 weekend there, Pensacola, 1968. Well, 1 week before I got married. I got married in November. We drove down to Pensacola. There's a honeymoon. It took about 2 weeks to get down there. Went down to Pensacola, Florida. And we got down on a Friday afternoon, and we looked for a place to live. We found a place Saturday morning. We moved in Sunday. Monday, I had to report the flight training. And that's how fast the turnaround time was down in Pensacola, Florida. So I had a new wife. So she said, when should I pick you up? I said, well, it's the Navy. I said, we'll probably be done about 3 o'clock. But it says, most people around 3:30 or 4 o'clock. There'll probably be some paperwork that I have to sign or something. Sure. I didn't see her for 7 weeks. That's how much I knew about Navy training. So I got to call her 7 weeks later. I got to call her. I met her at chapel. Hey, are we still married? She says, yeah, we're married. Well, fantastic.
You were questioning whether she might have bailed on you because you couldn't talk to her?
Yes. She had gotten a teaching job. She was all set.
And did you train on fixed-wing aircraft?
Yes. I was in the last class. I got to land on a carrier in the fixed-wing aircraft. After that class, if you went helicopters, you did not get to fly fixed-wing. So I flew the T-34, then I flew the T-28. We had instrument training in the T-28, and then I flew the T-28 on a carrier. Then I went into helicopters after that.
And was that because you wanted to go to helicopters or they wanted you to?
Yes, I chose helicopters, yes. I'm out in the yard one day. These helicopters fly over my house where we were living. We were living in Milton, Florida, which is real close to Ellison Field. And all of a sudden, I look up and I see wave after wave of helicopters. So I hopped in the car and said, they landed at Ellison Field. So I drove up there. I sat a sticker on my car so I could get in the base. Told one of the pilots there. He says, yeah. He says, these are new training helicopters. They're brand new Bell helicopters, the Bell H-57s. And they look new and they smell new. They have new smell in them and everything. And that's cool. I want to fly these. So that's why I chose helicopters.
And for someone who's never experienced it, how would you explain the difference between flying a fixed-wing aircraft and a helicopter?
They fly exactly the same until you get to hover. You slow down a helicopter, you go into a hover. And in fixed-wing, you slow down, you crash. So you got to keep airspeed up in a fixed-wing airplane. So hovering was a little bit challenging at first. They would always fly us out to a field. That always puts in a corner. That was for why they put us in a corner of the field. Why don't they put us on the middle of the field? That was landing right in a corner of the field where we couldn't move right or left or forward. So it taught us to hover.
It sounds like you took to it pretty naturally. It became pretty comfortable for you?
Well, I don't like to do it naturally, but I finally developed skills that it took, yes.
And how did you feel about the prospect of heading overseas?
Well, it didn't really bother me that much because I was going to Atsugi, Japan, and I really didn't know what was going to happen there over there. So it was a big move for both of my wife and I. Our helicopter training took place at Imperial Beach, California. From there, we went to Atsugi, Japan. From Atsugi, Japan, we deployed to the Tonkin Gulf, though. I guess I wasn't aware of that.
Surprise. And explain to all of us what your unit was and what you guys were expected to do.
Our unit was called HC-7. We had two helicopters. We had Clementines, those were the H-2s. The H-3s, they were called Big Mothers. So I had two deployments as an H-2 pilot, so I was a Clementine pilot for two deployments. Then as I was ready to make aircraft commander, the H-2, the Navy, or our squadron, will say our H-2s, a new program for H-2s called LAMPS, Light Airborne Multipurpose systems. So we lost our H-2s, so we just had H-3s. So our squadron, now we needed more H-3 pilots. Our skipper, commanding officer, he called up our admiral, I need some H-3 pilots. And our skipper, he told the admiral, said, I've got a couple H-2 pilots, I'd like to train them, I'd like to transition them into H-3s. The admiral agreed. So we had five flights with our squadron in the H-3 helicopter, about the use of the FRS. Normally you go through an FRS when you fly a new airplane. So my co-pilot and I were the only two people that I know of that transitioned just within the squadron. So our squadron, they gave us five flights in a helicopter, the H-3. It is HH-3 Alphas in our helicopters. HH is a heavy helicopter, 3 Alpha, the big mothers. But we had to take a check ride from the FRS, Fleet Replacement Squadron, which was HS-10. So the HS-10 instructor, he comes over to our squadron, briefs with us, and he tells us what to expect and everything. So we said, yeah, okay. So the first thing he did, he snagged an engine on takeoff. That's what they do in HS-10. They snag an engine on takeoff, and they see how you react. What he didn't realize, our helicopters are 3,000 pounds heavier because of the armament we have. We have 3,000 pounds of armament. He didn't realize that. So he pulled the snag of the engine back. We're used to it, though, so I had to lower the collective really fast to save the RPM. But it all happened so fast. He snagged the engine back. The RPM just drooped down. Then our warning light comes on. Then our rotor speed comes on. It goes below 90%, and I lowered the collective real fast and landed softly on the runway. He said, call for a pad. So I was still right at Imperial Beach. They have pads for training. So I said, call for a pad. We got pad 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Landed there. He said, thanks for saving my butt. And I said, why? What do you mean? He says, these helicopters are pretty heavy, aren't they? Said, yeah, they're heavy. He says, you just passed your check ride. He says, then I explained to me the differences between your helicopter and our helicopters. It's for the SH-3 Alphas, which is an anti-submarine warfare helicopter. So I explained the differences for the rest of the flight. So it was a good flight.
And I know we're going to hear about a couple missions in particular for which you were decorated, but you mentioned multiple deployments flying the Clementines first. Anything stand out about that time? Can you give us a sense of what kind of flights you were making, what the purpose of them was, what your duty over there was?
Our duty was we deployed from the carriers, and we were aboard non-aviation ships, either cruisers or destroyers that could hold a helicopter. Our purpose was to stand search and rescue for Vietnam War, where I was on alert 30 status. We had to be ready to launch within 30 minutes from three stations, from Northern Station, which was called Oswald, and Southern Station, which was called Red Crown, and we always had an aircraft on a carrier. That's our Yankee Station. So we always had a helicopter and a crew on those three boats, on those three geographic locations at all times.
So you just had to be ready to jump into action, because if there's a pilot down somewhere, he needs rescuing now. Time really matters.
Yes.
How often did that happen?
Oh, not very often. Our squadron was formed in 1967, and from 67 to maybe 70, it was quite active. Then from 70 to 72, there was no very little action. Then it started up again in 1972. That's when I kind of got over there.
There's a mission at the end of July in 1972 for which you were awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. What can you tell me about that mission?
Well, that was my third flight in the HH-3 helicopter. And the first flight I got a rescue. My very first flight in the H-3 helicopter, I go over with Bill Young. We're brand new H-3 pilots. My very first mission, I get a rescue. An F-4 had, Air Force F-4 had gotten hit over land. He made it out to the water. That was our primary area of responsibility, was from the water outwards to sea. We saw the guys eject, and we saw them punching out. We had to wait for them to land in the water, and we picked one up, and we had another big mother out there. The other big mother picked up the other pilot, and so that was pretty good. Then a week later, I flew, it was 3rd of July, at DFC. I was the aircraft commander on that flight. We launched. We were a Mayday call. I switched radios to ship. I told them there's a plane had gone down, and they were looking for a SAR asset. Could we be released?
And when you say SAR asset, that's a search and rescue target, basically, someone that you'll be able to rescue.
Yes. So I told them that we were available. So, okay, follow us. They came and they let us into Haiphong Harbor. We're in Haiphong Harbor. Well, we didn't know what to expect there. So they're shooting artillery guns at us, heavy artillery, 100-millimeter shells. A little danger of them really hitting us, except that they make big explosions in the water. So we came there. We saw the back end of an F-4 sticking out of the water. That's how shallow Haiphong Harbor is, sticking out of the water. So we knew we were close. Then we saw a guy splashing in the water. We went and picked him up right away. And our crewman, we normally do 10-10 drops. 10-10 drops. We come in real fast, pull nose up, rocket over. We're about 10 feet and 10 knots. Swimmer jumps out. And we take off and then come around and pick him up again. So we got the first guy without any problem. The second guy, he had to let off his smoke. We didn't need his smoke, except that he now became a target. They started bracketing with shells. We're afraid to put a crewman in the water now. Said, hey, hopefully you get in the sling. He got into the sling and we started moving off. Just as we moved off, a mortar hit his raft and it flew right up in the air.
So I just want to make sure people are following this. As part of your search and rescue operation, you have a guy on board your helicopter whose job is to go into the water to collect these guys and make sure they get in this sling and are lifted back to the helicopter, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And a search and rescue swimmer. Swimmer's job is to jump into the water as needed.
And so that worked with the first occupant of this downed plane. But there's another person still in the water who decides to put up a smoke signal, making sure that you guys see him. And you're saying you didn't really need that in situation. You knew where he was already, right?
That's correct, yes.
But when he did put that smoke up, that told the enemy where he was, and they started firing on where he was?
Yes, then they could see where he was. They see a smoke signal coming from the water. We were about 10 miles from shore. They couldn't see him.
But now they know where he is, so they're firing on that spot. So that fire, enemy artillery fire, puts him in jeopardy and the rest of you in jeopardy, right?
Yes. Now they can bracket in pretty close.
And had you ever been in anything like that before?
No, first time I've ever been fired at.
What did that feel like?
Well, it felt like I didn't want to do it again.
You know, when you're in those moments that no lecture or film or simulation can prepare you for, what goes through your mind? What was going through your mind at the controls of that helicopter?
Well, you're so busy flying the airplane, you really don't have time to think about anything else. You're just concentrating on doing your job, doing your mission. And our mission is to pick people up and get them aboard as quickly as we can.
Yeah, in fact, I've seen a couple times in references to your unit that your purpose was to prevent prisoners of war. You don't want these guys to end up in the Hanoi Hilton or anywhere else. So you're trying to make sure they not only get out of that alive, but they're not captured and they can return to duty. So I think we have an understanding of the situation and how treacherous it was for all of you. So what happened next?
They started firing us, so we had them on board. They started moving off, and then we just jigged out of there as fast as we could.
So you were able to get the second guy out of the water?
We got the second guy out of the water, yeah. We brought him up to the hoist, up to the door. We slowed down a little bit, and we kicked the rudder a little bit, and it was on our right side. We kind of slowed down, put a little bit of left rudder in, and that tilts the helicopter up a little bit, and he lets the hoist down, and he slides right into the cargo door.
But you did that while enemy fire is still incoming?
Well, yes, yeah, they followed us up for about 10 miles. They followed us up with artillery shells, but we could easily avoid the water spouts.
You say that, Harry, like that's no big deal, but this is your life and the rest of your crew and these two guys you just picked up.
Yes, that's true.
It sounds like you're flying for those 10 miles a bit of an obstacle course, because shells are hitting the water and you need to veer left or right to avoid that?
Yes, so you see explosions of the water going up in the air, we just avoid them.
But if you make a wrong turn or a wrong move, that could be it for all of you.
I guess that's right, yes. And in retrospect, that's exactly right. But in reality, we're just flying. We want to go off here, we want to go off there, we want to go off there. We just kind of avoided them.
Were you scared at all while that was going on?
I think so. But there's a big pucker factor, yeah.
And so that was July 30th, 1972, and they gave you a Distinguished Flying Cross.
Yes.
And when you get home, when you get back to the ship after a mission like that, is there like a decompression, a exhale, a relief? Or are you saying, boy, when's this going to happen again?
I said, it's okay with me if I never have to see enemy fire again.
But that's not how it worked out.
No. It's not what the Lord had in store for us at all.
Not by a long shot. He would encounter plenty more enemy fire, especially on August 6th, 1972. We'll hear about the mission that earned Harry the Navy Cross when we come back. Check out photos and a special video with Harry at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with Navy Cross recipient Harry Zinzer of Hanford, California. Originally from Flint, Michigan, they called him Harry the Horse when he started running back for Wheaton College. And a few short years later, with his wife back home in the States, Harry was flying search and rescue missions with the Sea Devils of HC-7 during the Vietnam War. He started out in UH-2A Clementines, but then transitioned to a heavier helicopter, the HH-3A Bad Mother, which is what he would end up flying on August 6th, 1970. A day this decorated pilot will never forget.
Well, I had two rescues already. Well, but he had one. Next time we fly, they put us together. This is on a log mission. Log mission is a logistics mission to drop off supplies. We're headed up towards the north, towards Oswald, which is about 200 miles from the DMZ. So we're flying up north. We're actually got classified materials we have to take up to ships that are near Oswald. Oswald is a station that's up north. So we go there, we drop off materials to different ships. We still have materials on board for the next day. Now we took off from Midway, we had to land on Saratoga. We knew that when we launched from Midway, because the ships, they change every so often. On the Yankee Station, they change. We swap, and so we had to take out all our personal gear with us too. It means letters from home and stuff like that.
So you weren't expecting that you guys are going to be rescuing anybody this day?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. So we get up to North Star, we have our personal gear, plus we have a confidential gear on board helicopter. We land there for the night, normal routine day, normal landing. Our crew was kind of there, they hit the rack. I usually stayed up a little bit later, and I was the last one to go to Iraq, so before I retired for the evening, I went into CIC, this Combat Information Center. She says, so says, hey, Lieutenant, says, go over here. Says, they're getting ready to launch one of your big mothers, overland, to overland, for a rescue overland. I go, what? He says, yeah, South Star, 2 miles to the south of us. We had a helicopter on board there. They're ready to launch them. No, I says, Chief, that'll never happen. He says, we don't go over land. He says, yeah, they're getting ready to launch them over land. And the radios crackled, and we heard him say, Red Crown, that's call sign for South Star. I said, Red Crown. He says, have you launched your big mother yet? I said, no, semi. Then they came back later, about a minute later. This is Red Crown. He says, our big mother's down. We heard a radio call. He says, break, break. He says, Oswald, this is Jehovah. Launch your big mother now. Jehovah was call sign for the Admiral when he spoke on the radio. We have people who have been through the entire Vietnam War, they've never heard Jehovah on the radios. We're in twice that night. First time was when he told the Red Crown to launch a big mother. She says, what? Yeah, it's the Adjutant Chief. I call your skipper. He has an emergency flight course where we have to launch. He says, I can't call my skipper. I says, why can't you call your skipper? He says, well, she's orders not to bother the skipper at night. I says, you got to call him tonight. Or I tell you, you won't have a job tomorrow. I think I was right. Because they called emergency flight corps, and CO was at the helm when we took off. I know he was. So I was the first one out to the Hilo. Had a flashlight with me. I pre-flighted the helicopter. So I took the engine covers off. I got in the center seat, and I had a number. One engine started by the time my cobot got out there. So he says, what's up? I says, hey, we're launching. Now, back then, when you took off from a non-aviation ship, you could not land on it at night. We did not have night vision goggles back then at all. We could take off from a non-aviation ship, but we could not land. So I knew we were going to head back. I knew we'd be landing in the Midway, about 200 miles away. We had 3 hours of gas on board. We fly 100 miles, about 100 knots. It took 2 hours to get to the carrier. But we had to stay low because we were up in Haiphong Harbor, and we had to fly below the radar. So we're about 10 miles off the shore. So we're flying at 500 feet. We have radio comms with the ship for about 30 miles. So we flew about another 40 miles before we had comms again. So I briefed our crew and said, what's up? I said, crew, the A-7 pilot has been shot down over North Vietnam. They want to launch our big mother to the south, but they're down, so they're launching us. So what are they launching us for? So I don't know. So we launched, and we're now the primary search and rescue vehicle. And I briefed them that he had been shot down about 2 hours ago. They had not heard from him. They had to come up on voice in order for rescue to be made. We knew the area where we were shot down, heavily fortified with the North Vietnamese Army, and so we thought he had been captured. But come to find out, he had not been captured. He's a pretty savvy guy himself. First of all, he got hit by a SAM missile, surface-air missile. He saw one coming on his radar. He avoided it, but he got hit by another one that he did not see. It's usually what happens. He was going through 2,000 feet uncontrolled when he bailed out. Minimum uncontrollable safe bailout altitude, as I was told later, is about 10,000 feet for an A7.
So the minimum safe altitude to bail out of an A7 is 10,000 feet. If you're bailing out less than that, there's no guarantee that you're going to survive this. And you said he was only at 2,000 feet?
He was only 2,000 feet when he bailed out.
So the odds were not in his favor?
Not at all. Uh-huh. So he got about two swings in his chute and he was on the ground. Mm-hmm. He landed right next to his aircraft, which was a ball of fire. He heard people, gunfire, so he knew he had to get out of there right away. So he got out of his parachute right away. He ran into some small bushes, hid there. Mm-hmm. He said within minutes, there was at least 12 NVA troops there at the wreckage site. So he said they came up to this bush where he was hiding in. So they urinated in the bush. But he said it was so black out that night, he couldn't be seen. It was a black night. Mm-hmm. One of the black nights that I ever flown in. We logged about 5 hours of instrument time, all total blackness. But it was a dark night that saved him. He said if they had a flashlight or a dog, he said he'd been captured.
But you guys don't even know if he's made it. You don't know anything about where exactly he is. So how do you eventually find out that he's alive and you have a chance to rescue him?
Well, so he didn't come over his radar for about 2 hours. But we launched. And by the time we launched, we launched 2 hours after he was shot down. They had not heard from him. What had happened during that time is he was on the ground. He was escaping, evading. And then they left. He had to get on his radio. Well, he had moved a considerable distance. He didn't have his radio. He had put his pocket up here, flights his pocket up here. He knew he had to get his radio or be picked up. So he went to reach for his radio, and it was missing. It fell out of his pocket. So he's in rice paddies. So he crawls on his hands and feet for the next hour and a half looking for his radio. Finds about an hour and a half later. Mm. That's when he finally came up on voice. Then when we got within range of the carrier radio comms, we found out that he had come up on voice. That's what took him so long to come up on voice, though. And they said, okay, Big Mother, you're going to be ready to go in. But just before they get ready to go, he hears footsteps behind him. So he calls off. He says, don't bring any heels in now. We were really low on fuel, so we had to get fuel. I already prepared for the ship to come and refuel us. Then our skipper relieved us. Our skipper, he was an old-time war vet, and he knew a lot about combat SAR himself. Commander Dave McCracken, good skipper. So we're kind of breathing. We got a sigh of relief. We're getting kind of easy now. We're refueling. We have to do helicopter flight refueling from a small ship that's not big enough, that does not have deck to land on IH-3 helicopter. So we come over the deck, burr hoist down, hook down, pick up the cable and move offside over helicopter about 10 feet above the water. Hover there alongside a ship while we take out fuel.
Okay, so when you say you're relieved by your skipper, you mean McCracken's in another helicopter, and now it looks like he's going to be the one to conduct the rescue, right?
That's exactly right, yes. We were up on SAR frequency, search and rescue frequency. So now we switch off search and rescue frequency, and we're on a ship's frequency to do our HIFR, our helicopter flight refueling. That was kind of hard. Found out later that the ship was not qualified, was not certified to do HIFRs. Their pump wasn't working quite right. We broke connection right away. So we don't know why we broke connection. So it takes about 10 minutes to the night IFR pattern. So we broke connection. So we had to go around and do a right-hand circle, come around the ship again, land, not land, but hover over deck, pick up those again, come and set aside, 10-foot hover, hover along the ship at night. Well, we broke connection again. So we came around a third time. Connection secure. We started pumping on fuel. I wanted to take out enough fuel so it would give us 15 minutes search time and get back to the ship plan with 15 minutes of fuel. That's what I was looking for. We were down below 1,000 pounds of fuel. 1,000 pounds was good for an hour, and I went an hour and a half. So we didn't have much to pump. We only had to pump on 500 pounds. But their pumps did not. We were burning fuel almost as fast as we were burning it.
So you're trying to fill up, but you're burning as much as you're taking on. So you're kind of treading water when it comes to fueling up.
Exactly right. So I switched the SAR frequency So the rescue's going. And first thing I hear is, where's all those helicopters? What's the matter with those damn helicopters? And I'm saying, whoa, I'm wondering, whoa, what's going on here? Then I hear over there is, well, first helicopter went to get gas. What happened to the second helicopter? He reported low on fuel, so he went to get fuel too. What was the first one? Why isn't the first one back yet? So I get over there and says, guys, hey, knock it off. I said, I was the first helicopter. I'm getting fuel. I have problems getting fuel right now. I'll be there as soon as I can. So I looked at the fuel. We had enough fuel to get there and get back. So I was interested. So I said, catch fueling. Called up the dancing commander. It's Commander Jim Ernst in an A6. He did a wonderful job that night. I called him up and said, hey, we're ready to come on in now. So now we become the primary helicopter. We're no backup now.
So if this pilot's going to get rescued, it's you guys or nobody else?
That's right. And when, if we went down, we had nobody to rescue us either. So we go in. Our crewman reminds me, he says, sir, he says, we still have our coverage of materials on board. I said, that's okay, Smetsky. He's called Ski. I said, it's okay, Ski. Leave him right there because we're going to come back. He told me later, he said, they gave him all the confidence in the world. I said, don't throw the materials overboard. So we go over to North Vietnam. We have confidential materials on board. We have our personal gear and everything. I wasn't going to throw my personal gear overboard. So we head over land. He clicks the mic. He says, sir, would you say a prayer for us? They realize that these guys are guys that live in bars, our crewmen. They live in the bars. They didn't drink anybody under the table. He asked me to say a prayer. I said, ski. He said, I've already prayed once, but I'll pray again. Click the mic, and I prayed to the Lord to protect us. And sure enough, he did. So as we go over land, I expected all hell to break loose as soon as we crossed the beach. I report feet dry. Feet dry is when you cross the ocean. Go from over the water, you go over land. Mm-hmm. Well, feet dry. Man, said all hell to break loose. They were going to single shot fired. Didn't see anything coming at us. Yeah, we're just north of the bend. Then I saw a ridge line up ahead. Karst line. And the words came to me from Psalm 121. Where I had memorized Psalm 121 from our coaching and principal's class at Wheaton College. It says, I will look unto the hills from whence cometh my help. My help comes from the Lord, which made the heavens and the earth. I saw those hills, I saw that verse came right to my mind there, like I had a HUD display on it.
So we've been talking about there's a pilot, he needs to be rescued, you guys needed gas. There's a lot of things that can go wrong here. But now you're coming over land, low, so surface-to-air missiles can knock you out of the sky. And then I think your visibility isn't great either, right?
Right, the visibility is getting reduced, the cloud layer.
But you see these hills, this karst, 3,500-foot plateau, and the first thing you think of is a verse you learned in a coaching class in college?
Yes, it's just amazing how that happened. And the last part of that verse said, he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. He'll guide your foot, and your foot will not move. I looked down on my boot, and I started adjusting the lights in the cockpit, and there's one peanut bulb. I had a light on it, and it was shining on my boot. Should not suffer that foot to be moved. And I looked at my foot that night, and I saw it. So I'm going to let that light shine right on my boot. My boot's going to stay there all night long. And I looked down several times in the rescue, and I saw the light shine off my boot.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want to understand what the significance of that is to you. So when you look at your boot not moving, that represents the mindset that you had in that moment?
Yes. Just renewed my confidence that the Lord was with us and he's going to bring us out of this. He's going to bring us through this.
So you've got how many people on board this helicopter?
4 people on board the helicopter right now.
Yourself, your co-pilot, 2 crewmen. You've got a pilot on the ground whose life is in your hands. And then you mentioned you have all your personal materials and classified information that if the enemy gets a hand on it, could wreak a lot of damage, right?
We're getting in a lot of trouble, that's for sure.
The stakes of this mission are pretty high.
They're building up now, yes, they're building up now.
So what happened next?
So we go over land, and we now have to make an IFR descent. We're 3,500 feet across the ridgeline, but there's now a cloud layer. There's a black night now, it's a cloud layer. We have to get below those clouds. So we set our radar altimeter 200 feet. We're going to spiral descent down through the clouds. We break out through the clouds before we hit 200 feet. As soon as we break through the clouds, we see a pencil flare go off. So, man, this is going to be a piece of cake. Found a haystack, now we've got to find a needle in a haystack. We just found a needle, so we thought. So we head for it. Our NC commander, he says, hey, get out of there, big man. It's a trap. It's a trap. Get out of there. So now we figure, oh, crap. So we pull in power. We had reset our radar altimeter to 30 feet. Our radar altimeter is a Raw's warning, saying we're below 30 feet. So I turned on a spotlight just in time because there's a grove of trees ahead of us. It was about 100 feet high, or 30 feet, which is another time pump power, cross over trees. The guy pointed aiming a gun at us with our spotlight on. And I see muzzle flashes going off. Scared the heck out of me. So we banked hard to her, banked hard to the right. And then Jim comes over the rail and says, I'm at your six. We actually passed over him. We didn't realize we had passed over him. We did.
Jim is Jim Lloyd, the pilot who had gone down. You two have been friends ever since, but at this point, you've never met him. So you hear the pilot saying, I'm at your six. That means he's behind you.
That's right. It means we just passed over him. Mm-hmm. So we turn around. He says, I'm at your six. As we're turning, we see I see a figure of a guy running. He's got his arms crossed like this. He's in an American flight suit. So I figure that's him. He says, come right 10 degrees, big mother. So he turned right. He said, no, your other right. And that's a common mistake that pilots make.
Because it was his right, but not your right.
Yeah, but we know exactly what I meant, because that's what happens. We just search and rescue train at Fallon, Nevada. That happens at Fallon, Nevada all the time. So we learned that. So as soon as he said, your other right, and knew exactly what I meant. So he came there. Now he's scared because now he's going to show a light. He said, show a light, damn it, show a light. He's afraid to turn on his light because his light, he has a strobe light, but it's sewn into the collar. Now he's got to show a light, so he didn't want to show a light. But I said, hey, man, if you want to get rescued, you got to show a light. So he finally turned the light on, and saw a strobe. As soon as the strobe went on, about four of the strobes went off, immediately went off in the area. So they were watching. Second crewman was behind me. He said, sir, he says, there's the first strobe that went off. Sure enough, that was him.
So I just want everybody to understand, you know, what you guys are dealing with. He turns his on, and then immediately four others go on. So for you, in the dark, you could have picked any one of those five. You got an 80% chance of picking the wrong one and dying.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But because one of your crew members saw the first one and knew where it was, that's where you went.
Yeah.
Were you at all hesitant to go to that one?
No, because it was then after we saw him running. So we headed that direction, and then we saw him running. So it was him then.
They knew it was him, but they still had to find a way to retrieve him and escape safely. And that was nowhere near a sure thing. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for a short video of Harry Zinser FaceTiming with Jim Lloyd, that pilot he rescued 50 years ago in Vietnam. And Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Before we pick up this remarkable rescue story with Harry Zinser, why don't I read the citation that accompanied his Navy Cross? It says, for extraordinary heroism in action on the night of 6 August and early morning of 7 August 1972, while serving with Helicopter Combat Support Squadron 7, Detachment 110, embarked on USS Saratoga, CVA 60, as pilot in command of a combat rescue helicopter during nearly 5 hours of a coordinated search and rescue effort for United States Navy pilot downed in North Vietnam, Lieutenant Zinser, in face of intense enemy fire, commenced a low-level flight and turned on his landing lights in order to facilitate the search. Although his aircraft was repeatedly hit by enemy ground fire, He continued the search until the downed pilot was visually located. Lieutenant Zinsser then carried out a skillful landing, picked up the downed airman, and succeeded in flying his crippled aircraft at treetop level back to the safety of Saratoga. By his outstanding aeronautical skill, courageous leadership, and inspiring dedication, Lieutenant Zinsser reflected great credit upon himself and upheld the highest traditions of the United States Naval Service. That Navy Cross hangs on the wall of now-retired Navy Captain Harry Zinsser. And when we left off, Harry, you had found Jim Lloyd, that pilot who had miraculously survived a low-level bailout from his crippled jet, but you and your crew still had a lot of work left to do.
So now the thing is, how do we pick him up? Because there's a lot of small art fire going off now. Mm-hmm. And as far as we can into hover, so our crewman, he had to let out a 30-foot of cable, throws the cable out, gets in, jungle penetrator, gets on jungle penetrator, then we take off. And we reel him up. Just like from the water pickup. We make a decision, we got to land. Because there's too much small art fire going on. They hit an engine, and we go sitting in the engine, we lose partial power on engine. We cannot hover at night. We're too heavy to hover, single engine. But if we're on the ground, we take off using ground effect. As we pull in the hover, they open up with a AAA gun, 37 millimeter gun probably, 100 rounds a minute. It's mounted on a mobile truck. The barrels have to be adjusted manually. So it's already adjusted for about a 30-foot helicopter, point-blank range. As we pull in the hover, all of a sudden he opens up fire, we start landing. I can just see the guys sitting there cranking the barrels down, passing off.
So they're cranking it down into place to try to be able to shoot you.
And we land in, and we land right next to him. Our crewman reached out and grabs him, hauls, yanks him in the helicopter. He thought he was captured at that point. He thought he was captured. And we take off right as the last bullet clears our helicopter. We got the car, so we have to cross 3,500 feet, I know. So we're about 3,500 feet. And I'm hauling, I'm at Redline Airspeed. Redline Airspeed is 120 knots in the helicopter. If we got about 150 knots, we started getting a buffet. Slight buffet at 150 knots. Everything was nice and clear. I thought about jinking. Jinking is the only thing that we had done that night. Jinking is maneuver. It's designed that if you jink at the right time, if you place crewman at the back and he sees a missile coming at you, he calls break now, like a heat-seeking missile. You jink, or left the missile miss you. Mm-hmm. So I just had a gut feeling, let's jink. So I jink to the right, and a missile goes by us on the left side. Of course, it's, geez, they're shooting missiles at us. Jink the other way, sir. So stand by, ski. I jink to the left. Another one goes by us on the right. They're usually fired in pairs. We did not know that. Had I jinked a second or two later, we wouldn't be here today. Then we crossed the Karst line, and we did an auto rotation down to about 200 feet. We didn't want any more missiles fired at us. Then we're at the water's edge line and reported feet wet. It's amazing. There were six aircraft that I reported right in the order. I imagine they went in order seniority. They had Big Mother. Sierra Hotel, good job. And now we had to get gas. Our little fuel lights had been on for about 15 minutes. So now we had a good 5 minutes of gas left. We started gradually climb up a little bit higher. And it was, sure enough, they brought a ship into us. This is Cleveland. This is LPD. Had a big deck on it. We landed there.
There's a lot going on there. I didn't live this, you did. But when you are staring at limited fuel and not knowing if you're going to make it to a ship in time to fuel up, is there some kind of thought or conversation about, we've been through all this and now we're going to run out of fuel?
Yeah, that certainly goes through your mind. And that's what I thought about. You measure your fuel very closely.
This is a long day, a day that had everything, it seems like. I want to put it in perspective, though. Not that any mission is typical or average. They're all unique. But what would you say the length of a typical search and rescue mission would be, time-wise?
Well, certainly within 3 hours of fuel that we have on board.
So usually you've got one tank of fuel, 3 hours worth, and you're going, retrieving, returning, all within those 3 hours.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
But on August the 6th, 1972, how many hours were you flying that helicopter for?
5.7 hours. I was there most of that time. It was all nighttime, too. Uh-huh. It was a black night. That's what saved Jim Lloyd being a black night, but that's what made the mission hard to fly.
And there's so many questions I'd like to ask you about this. I can tell that you have a lot of respect for this pilot, Jim Lloyd, and you guys have become really good friends over the years. How often do you guys talk?
Well, he called me, first year he called me on 6 August. He said, hey, here, do you remember what you were doing a year ago? This time I said, yeah, picking your butt up off, Vietnam. He calls me, second year. You know what you were doing 2 years ago? And then last 6 August, he called me again. He said, do you remember what you were doing 50 years ago tonight? So he calls me every year on 6 August. Let's say 7 o'clock, this phone call.
Is there an element of what he did that day or what he went through that has impressed or made an impact on you?
Well, I think he certainly went through a lot that night. He played it very cool.
And you weren't the only guy on that helicopter. What do you appreciate about your co-pilot and the rest of your crew that night?
Well, I have the highest esteem for all of them. I'm Bill Young. He's a fully qualified aircraft commander, as I was. And he actually was in the right seat. And he did most of the flying that night. And I was able to sit back and make decisions. And he comfortably flew the airplane.
You guys were a good team, obviously. Obviously, you've had a lot of time to think about this. You've written it up. You've seen what Jim's written. You two talk every year on the 6th of August. When you think back of it, it's been 50 years. Is there a moment or two within that whole ordeal that you still think about and marvel and say, how in the world did that happen that way?
Oh, yes. I still remember. I still remember very vividly. We're going to look out the left side after turn on the spotlight. Well, the guy standing there aiming at us with his gun. The muzzle flash is going off. And I have a picture, a lot of the light shining on my boot. The Lord said, he shall not suffer thy foot to be moved. Mm-hmm. Told he that keepeth Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep.
Something tells me you probably never looked at that passage, Psalm 121, the same either.
That's right, yeah.
That kind of makes it come alive a little bit.
Sure does, yes.
And what did it feel like when you finally went to bed that night? I mean, what, because that's, you know, everybody can identify with that. The end of a long day, what do they think of? What do they reflect on? Do you remember what you reflected on that night?
Well, we landed, our skipper, he had landed on the ship first, so he was there waiting for us. Remember, he hugged us. The skipper, put me down. So he hugged me, he kept hugging me. I felt a little embarrassed, you know. Skipper, put me down. And then we all went in the wardroom. Jim Lloyd, he went in too. And he came out, and then he was in a set of PJs. We just celebrated that night for another couple hours in the wardroom of Cleveland.
And they inspected your helicopter the next day?
Yeah, we inspected the helicopter the next day. We had a total of 12 bullet holes in the helicopter. One shot at Razor Terror drive shaft. Had been a couple inches lower, we may not be here either.
So 12 bullet holes in your helicopter, and one of them was in the tail rotor's crankshaft. So if that was just a very small amount higher or lower, that would have knocked you guys out of the sky or made it so you couldn't control it?
Yes, it would have been a little bit lower. Mm-hmm. It just grazed the top of the tail rotor drive shaft.
Well, and I know that you've done a lot of teaching in your life. I mean, you spent 26 years in the Navy, and then when you retired, you started the junior ROTC program at Lemoore High School near NAS Lemoore. And so you taught a lot of future naval officers. I'm wondering what August 6th, 1972 taught you, because that's an experience. That's one day in your life that you've probably spent more time talking about that day than any other day in your life. What was the lesson of that day? What did it teach you?
Well, the big thing it taught me was the Lord was with us that night. He certainly was. People ask you, were you scared? Well, you're not scared at the time. You're so busy.
Well, and you say that, you know, that's what it taught you. So I'm just wondering if there are other things in the 50 years since that maybe you faced with a different degree of confidence because you were able to get through that night.
I think so. It makes you put other things in perspective, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't worry about the small stuff anymore. We don't worry about it as much, the small stuff. You don't worry about that as much anymore.
Yeah, and there's another part of your story, and if there's anything you don't want to talk about, you know, feel free to tell me that. But like a lot of people your age who served in Vietnam, you were exposed to Agent Orange. You didn't know what that was going to mean for your life. What are some of the things that you've seen that you believe are the effects of that exposure?
Well, I've developed Parkinson's as a result of that. It affected my speech very significantly. It affects my walk. So I have a hard time walking, I have a hard time talking. So those are two big things that affects me. I feel my mind is still fairly good, though.
Well, and we've heard that firsthand with your memory of something 50 years ago in very clear fashion. There's not too many people who can wear a medal called the Navy Cross. When did you find out that they were giving you the Navy Cross? The only thing higher than that's the Medal of Honor.
Yes. We have one Medal of Honor winner in 87. It's Lieutenant Clyde Lassen. And we did everything that he did. And so we're going to write up our award for the Medal of Honor. But we were told that the ship would not release the Medal of Honor because they got word back from Washington, D.C. that the climate was not right. We were trying to draw down on the war. They did not want any publicity.
So I want to make sure I understand this right. So your commander, was that McCracken who wrote you up?
Yes.
What he wrote up, his petition for the medal, he said this deserves the Medal of Honor, right?
That's correct.
But the top brass in Washington said, we're trying to ease out of this war. We don't want something that gets people more excited about it, so don't give them the Medal of Honor.
That's right. They didn't want any congressional involvement at all.
So you get the Navy Cross, which is, again, something very few people get. Did that affect how you felt about it?
No, not at all. The Cross is the highest military award. We felt good about that.
And was there a special ceremony to present it?
Yes, there was. Our Sinkback Fleet himself came down. Admiral Clary came down. Mm-hmm. Presented us the awards.
That's the Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet. What did that feel like when that's getting pinned to your chest?
Well, it feels pretty good.
I guess I should ask you, too. I mean, there's so many other stories you could tell that we didn't touch on here. But when you think back of 26 years in the Navy, 76 years on the planet, is there something that you would say you're most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm really thankful for my two wives that I had. My first wife was with me for 44 years. She was a wonderful lady. She passed away in her sleep. She died of an enlarged heart, and I knew that she had a big heart. And then I met my other wife. We've been married 10 years now. She's a wonderful lady, too. Mm-hmm. So tell everybody, I did two women in my life, and I married both of them.
You're batting 1,000.
Yeah.
So you started the Junior ROTC program in a Navy town, Lemoore, California, at Lemoore High School. You taught a lot of kids. What's the most important thing that you think young people today need to understand about the price of freedom and guys like you who are willing to pay it?
Well, you're exactly right. They need to understand the price of freedom. That freedom is not free.
Well, if there's anything else that is important for you to share, feel free, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing this incredible story with us, and thank you for your example.
Thank you, Paul, for taking your time and coming down here and talking to me. Sure, I appreciate it.
What a privilege to hear Harry Zinzer's story. And wouldn't you like to hear this story from the perspective of that downed pilot, Jim Lloyd? We hope to have him on Hometown Heroes in the very near future. But for now, here's a short clip from a video you can find at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. The pilot who was rescued talking to the pilot who picked him up.
As I said before many times, Harry, and I'll say it many times in the future, you know, thank you for my life. It's been great. You know, when you get older, at the time, I think about, well, I almost lost my, you know, it almost ended at 27 years and 60 days. But as I, 50 years looking back, it's not just the future. It is actual events and people and family and whatever that I've had that I would have missed out on if it wasn't for you guys. So, again, thank you.
You bet, Jim.
So again, you can check out that video online, and you can look forward to hearing Jim Lloyd's story on a future episode. We're out of time today, but I do want to thank Harry's friend and fellow aviator, Patty Briney, for facilitating our privilege of sharing Harry's story with you today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time when we'll be reminded once again through the stories of our veterans of those four words you heard Harry say just a few minutes ago. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.